From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 38 for Friday, the 5th of August, 2011. On the show this week...
I thought, I'm going to become Nim's friend, and I'm going to hang with Nim, and we'll see what happens. I mean, there wasn't much I could do for him in terms of the cage, but get him out.
Nim Chimpsky was a chimpanzee who was raised by a family in New York as a child in an attempt to study animal language acquisition. He's the subject of a documentary film called Project Nim by the team behind Man on Wire, and we talked to producer Simon Chin about how it all came together. We'll also take a look about whether it would be possible to tow an iceberg from Antarctica to Africa, investigate a little aperture science, and ask whether injecting yourself with horse blood and strapping on some hooves counts as art. Yay or nay? Find out as we gallop, fetlocks blowing in the wind, through the week in Wired News. Hello, I'm Duncan Gear. I'm a senior staff writer for Wired.co.uk, and joining me in Wired's safety pod, 2 miles above the riotous streets of London this week, is associate editor Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
We are very sad not to be joined by our regular host, editor Nate Langson, and his dulcet tones today, but I'm stepping into the breach in his place. Do you miss Nate?
I miss Nate a little bit.
It's strange not having his faintly northern accent washing over us.
I mean, you're doing a great job, by the way, but it's different.
Well, it's been a very different week in general this week. We were saying earlier about how this is probably the oddest week of the year so far.
Yeah, it's definitely up there in terms of differentness. In addition to not having Nate here, there have also been, as well, unless you've been living on the moon, you probably will have heard of it, but there have been riots in the streets of London.
Rampaging through Tottenham and Ealing and everywhere.
And let's not forget Birmingham and Manchester and I think Leeds and Liverpool as well. And it's been a kind of very strange, exciting and terrifying time.
Was the area around you affected very much?
No, I was almost kind of wanting something to kick off a little bit, just so I could talk about it and feel like part of the team. But
I didn't have much around near us either. I think the closest we got was a subway burning down. Not a subway, but the food chain subway.
Yeah, that's about right.
I mean, that was nothing to do with the riots. It was just an
unrelated arsonist.
Badly cooked Italian BMT or something.
I think not having a JD Sports in London Bridge is probably a good contributing factor to me not having riots there.
But yeah, let's start our podcast today with a little bit of a discussion about the rioting that's been happening in London over the past few days, and more particularly some of the announcements that have just been made by David Cameron, the Prime Minister, about blocking social networks.
Yeah, I mean, he's making some pretty ridiculous comments. He said he had in a debate in the House of Commons today. He was saying how he's looking into finding ways that he could work with the police and investigators generally, how they could find people who were planning on committing criminal offences and then stopping them from using social media.
How is that something you're possibly supposed to know, whether somebody is planning to do criminal activity or not?
I mean, clearly this is in reference to BlackBerry Messenger, which everyone's been freaking out about, being used to kind of direct people towards looting and some of the riots. And, you know, there's a huge amount of blame has been cast on BlackBerry and particularly the messaging service. And I think there's been a huge call for people to somehow be able to monitor these services, which... I personally think is a very, very bad and
it's reprehensible. It's horrific. But why do you? I mean, do you think how do you think RIM has been dealing with it? The company that makes BlackBerry phones.
Well, they're being fully cooperative. They've come out. They've said they're working with the police and they're working with the authorities. And I guess I don't really know what they should be expected to do. They've got to balance their customer privacy with the kind of state security. And I think, as with any other telecommunications company, they have to sometimes pass over data to the authorities. But I don't really know what else they can be doing. I mean, the talks of banning BlackBerry Messenger is genuinely absurd. BlackBerry Messenger is an incredibly popular service. It's used by loads of people, including a lot of teenagers, because it's free and it's brilliant. And the vast majority of users don't use it to arrange to meet up for rioting.
And I think probably quite an awful lot of people were using it to try and find out if their loved ones were safe on the nights of the rioting, rather than, you know, just using it to try and meet up to do some crimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Do some crimes.
To do some crimes.
We need to do some crimes, Duncan. Let's get on that BBM.
But I think it's really interesting about how people are interpreting BlackBerry Messenger as a social network. That's not really what I'd describe it as. It's more of just an instant messaging system.
Well, it is. But I think what people are focusing on is the one-to-many broadcast capacity that it's got. So you can message someone up to 200 people in the same message, a little bit like Twitter. So although it's closed and it can't be trawled by the authorities in the same way that Twitter and Facebook can be, I guess that broadcast facility means that it does turn somehow into a kind of contained social network.
I suppose so. And Twitter's been actually getting an awful lot of stick as well, which is odd considering I haven't seen any use of it to organise any kind of uprisings.
Yeah, but you wrote quite a good piece earlier this week, which is looking at how Twitter's been used to spread a lot of misinformation over the riots, haven't you?
There's an awful lot of panicking. I mean, it wasn't really... I think Twitter's role in all this hasn't really been to organise the rioting, but to almost organise the panic around the rioting.
Yeah.
I was looking at it the other day. I live in Holloway, and I had a search column set up for Holloway Road, and just the amount of stuff I saw on that about, you know, gangs of 50 people coming up the road, and I look out my window, and there was nobody there.
Yeah, I don't know even who started these rumours. And then all sorts of... I mean, you made the point, which the tweet that actually got retweeted by the Google account, that people shouldn't be writing apparently and then followed by some kind of scaremongering report.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you should be... Twitter should really be being used to share first-person experiences and eyewitness accounts, not, you know, something that you heard some bloke say because he heard some other bloke say it. But, I mean, that's one thing that communications networks do very, very well. They amplify Chinese whispers and they get worse and worse and worse. And that's just kind of in their nature. And
but
I think ultimately tech is completely neutral in all this. You can't blame BlackBerry Messenger or Twitter or any kind of network for the rioting.
No.
You blame the rioters.
Exactly.
You know?
And those rumours and that kind of activity can spread down the pub. It can spread, you know, just meeting in the park. It can spread and via email. It's not intrinsically linked to this sort of communications channels.
And what we're seeing in the government's response, you know, MPs calling for BlackBerry Messenger to be switched off and everything, is just ludicrous. It shows that they fundamentally misunderstand what social media is and how it works, despite so many of them suddenly having Twitter accounts.
Yeah, it's actually pretty terrifying, the kind of knee-jerk reactions we're seeing, especially, saying we need to ban or completely scan all of these social networks.
I think one thing that I thought was particularly interesting was while Cameron was making these announcements, there was a parody account on Twitter, a sort of Sky News parody account, saying that Sky News understands David Cameron has been in talks with the Chinese government to share web filtering technologies. Now, this got retweeted all over the place as real, and then pretty much everybody that retweeted it about 5 minutes later said, oh, yeah, that's a parody account, by the way.
Yeah, but it was so close to the truth, you know. Having listened to his speech, it was, you could almost expect this from happening. As he was talking about the cannons and turning off the mobile networks and using rubber bullets, it began to feel like that wasn't beyond the realms of possibility.
It's a great example of Poe's Law, which is an internet adage that says that without a clear indication of the author's intent, like a smiley or something like that, it's almost impossible to tell the difference between sincere extremism and exaggerated parody of extremism. But yeah, let's move on away from the rioting onto some slightly more... just gentle topics.
Gentle topics. Reading. That's good, isn't it? Duncan, what has Kindle done lately? What's Amazon been doing?
Well, Amazon has launched a web-based reader for its Kindle service, which is a way that you can get your Kindle library offline and be able to read it in your web browser.
And why have they done this?
Well, they've said because they want to make it easier for people to access their library and on any device and so on and so forth. But I think there's a little bit of reading behind the scenes that you can... Not reading behind the scenes. That's nonsense. Reading in between the lines that you can do here. And it's that Amazon is trying to get around some of the restrictions that Apple is placing on iOS apps.
And what are those?
Well, from 30th of June, any iOS apps that offer purchases in apps or subscriptions have had to hand over 30% of the proceeds from those subscriptions to Apple. So, for example, within Amazon's Kindle app, if you click a button and go to the Kindle store and buy a book, Apple is supposed to get 30% of the cost of that book, which is a ludicrous amount of money.
Yeah, and it wasn't doing this before.
No, not. And as a result, many apps have actually removed links to pages on the web where you can subscribe to their services. Spotify is one of them. Kindle is another. They've removed links from their apps that people could use to activate their subscription. So, for example, now if you download the Spotify app on iOS, it just asks you for a username and password. There's no way of you on your phone or iPad or whatever going to Spotify's website and signing up directly from the app.
Yeah.
You have to kind of work out how to do that off your own back, which is it's a bit of a shame, really, for usability purposes.
Yeah, so that means you have to kind of go into a browser and in order to access if you want to buy some books on Kindle and don't want to give Apple 30%, basically.
Exactly.
Or don't want Amazon to have to give Apple 30%.
And so Amazon is created this cloud reader, which works for the moment it only works in Chrome and in Safari, and that's Safari on Mac, PC, and the iPad. And it lets you get to your library and it lets you buy books and everything, but crucially it's not within the app, and that means that they don't have to pay that levy.
But then would you then be able to read the book through the app?
Yes,
you can want a later date.
You can read the book through the app if you want to. I'm pretty sure, because your Kindle library is spread across multiple devices. But you have to, off your own back, go to Amazon's website separately, buy it there, and then go back to the app. Yeah. And there can't be any links between the two.
I mean, if a lot of retailers end up doing this, it's going to be a bit of a nightmare for Apple, isn't it?
Absolutely. And Jack Gold, who is an analyst at J. Gold Associates, I presume the J stands for Jack, told VentureBeat that unless Apple modifies its charges, there's going to be more and more people trying to get around this and who aren't willing to cut their margins by 30%, and it could give Android, which has a much freer, more flexible business model, an advantage in the marketplace, which it really badly needs right now.
Yeah, definitely.
Because Android tablets really haven't taken off in the same way. But there's also quite a nice side benefit to all of this, and the great thing about Amazon's Kindle Cloud Reader is that it works across any device. Well, I say that at the moment it only works in Chrome and Safari, but if they implement it right across in HTML5, then you'll be able to look at it on your BlackBerry Playbook or your HP Touchpad and all these kinds of devices without Amazon, and this is crucial, having to develop and release an app for that platform.
Yeah.
And that could make these web services much, much more widely available in terms of web apps.
Yeah.
But it's not quite as great as some interesting research that you're about to tell us all about.
Yeah, well, sphincters. Most people know what they are, but did you
know? Go on, humour me. What's a sphincter, Liv?
It is a ring-like muscle that constricts a passage in the body.
What kind of passages?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of, obvious places where you have sphincters, and I think anal sphincters are the ones that people most know about. But actually, you have sphincters in your eyes.
Really?
And your mouth is a sphincter as well.
Oh.
In the eye, it controls the amount of light that goes in. It's the iris that closes and opens to let more light into your pupil. So fancy that.
So what's happened in sphincter news this week?
In sphincter news this week, there have been some researchers who have developed a bioengineered sphincter in the lab. They were working at the Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center. And what they've done is they've taken human sphincter muscle cells and they've engineered them in the lab, grown them around a kind of ring-shaped mold, and then they've implanted it under the skin of a mouse, and it's fully functioning, and it seems to work like the native tissue.
Lovely. And what goes wrong with a sphincter? Why would you need a new one?
Well, lots of things can go wrong. I mean, they can rupture, and obviously, it sounds amusing, but it must be horrendous for someone who has lost control of their anal sphincter to get incontinent, and it's pretty unpleasant, and it's very difficult to engineer or fix them once they're kind of broken. So this presents a big ray of hope for those people who have probably have their lives made a complete misery by this.
Is this happening in humans yet? You mentioned a mouse a minute ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long way off happening in humans. This is just one test in a mouse, and it, you know, there was 25 days where it was implanted and it developed a blood supply, but you know, it hasn't been tested in humans at all.
Okay.
So it'll watch this space.
All right. Well, let's let the listeners go and start their lunch again, and we'll just pop off for a quick ad break. We'll be back in a minute.
Wired magazine, now published digitally every month on iPad. Download the latest interactive issue, available now on the iTunes App Store.
Icebergs are some of the most beautiful and noble objects on Earth. Are they noble? I
don't know.
I'm just sort of making things up a little bit there.
I mean, no, I don't think they're noble.
I think they're quite noble. Icebergs are quite noble. But anyway, they are. So there's definitely one thing that they are, and that is wet. Icebergs
And cold.
And cold.
And big.
And big. All of these three things. Icebergs are. Should we start this again? There's a French engineer called Georges Mougin who has the idea of going to Antarctica, tying a great big rope around a 6 million ton iceberg and towing it up to Africa to melt it into drinking water.
I mean, this is just amazing. Like, how would this be the first thing you think of in order to take water to Africa?
Well, I guess his thought process must have been, there's no water here. Where's there lots of water that they don't need? I know, Antarctica.
Right, okay. So how does he propose that you'd actually... I mean, you've mentioned tying a big rope around it, but presumably it's a little bit more technical than that.
A little bit more technical. They're talking about sort of tying a kind of big tether around the back of the iceberg, but crucially, one that descends underground, using a skirt made from geotextile strips that creates it... that stops it from breaking apart on the journey from Newfoundland or the South Atlantic up to the Canary Islands.
Right. And then once you've, I mean, surely it would melt en route.
Yeah. It's what he's done is he's got in touch with a French technology firm called Dassault Systèmes, which create 3D worlds and algorithmic simulations. And what he's done is he's used these computer simulations to work out exactly how the iceberg exchanges heat with the sun and the rest of the water around it to try and get some idea of how much it would melt in transit, and also how it would crack and break up over time using meteorological and oceanographic data from satellites. So he fed that all into the thing, and to tow an iceberg from Newfoundland to the Canary Islands, for example. He worked out that it would take 141 days using just one tugboat, but it would lose about 38% of its mass during the trip, which isn't actually not that much.
No, there's no kind of sense of how much this might cost and whether a desalination plant might potentially...
It wouldn't be very efficient, no, and definitely not very cost effective. And also from a climatological perspective, taking frozen stuff from the poles and melting it down in the equator is kind of not what we're trying to achieve right now as a species.
Yeah, and presumably there might also be kind of microorganisms that be introduced in places where they kind of shouldn't be.
Yes, that could also definitely be a concern with invasive species and all that kind of thing. But yeah, best of luck to him. I don't know if he's going to get it off the ground or
it sounds
into
like
the ocean.
It's more of a kind of engineering thought piece, in the same way that we quite often see architects doing these ludicrous proposals, which would never get planning permission, but they kind of show off their best, you know, skills.
Speaking of ludicrous proposals.
Yeah, well, there's a woman who's been injecting herself with horse blood.
Really?
Yes,
that surprises me.
It surprises you, but it's been done as an art project by a French duo called Art Orienté Objet. I don't know if I pronounced it very well, and I'm really sorry for that accent I just did there.
You got my French accent in the last story, so yeah, that was bad enough.
The pair are Marion Laval-Jonté and Benoît Mongin, another bit like Mougin. Was that the previous guy?
Maybe.
And what they've done is they're trying to explore the boundaries between species. And so they've got a piece that they've called May the Horse Live in Me. And the woman, over a course of several months, injected herself with some blood plasma from a horse containing some of the horse kind of antibodies. And she slowly tried to build up immunity to the blood before, in a kind of final performance piece, injecting herself with the full range of horse antibodies in this plasma in front of an audience with a horse present. And then she had a kind of strange ritual where she put on these kind of prosthetic hooves and walked around the studio with a horse, bonding with a horse. And the amazing thing was, she said that after she, well, the first of all, the amazing thing was that she didn't have a massive allergic reaction to the blood being in her body, because
I presume that's because she built it up over time.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of injection of a foreign matter would normally provoke an anaphylactic shock, and she didn't do that, which was interesting. But she said that she had, as a result of injecting the blood, she had all of the emotions of a herbivore. She said, I couldn't sleep and I felt a little bit like a horse. I'm not quite sure what she meant by that. But
What emotions do herbivores have?
I don't know. Presumably it's like, where am I next going to find grass? Is this a good grass or is it a bad grass?
I'm sad because I haven't got enough grass.
Yeah. Oh, hooves.
Imagine they'd revolve quite a lot around grass.
I wish I had opposable thumbs. But yeah, I mean, it does sound amusing, but actually this art group, Art Orienté Objet, have a long history of working in this kind of bio art space, which is a really interesting and kind of complex art scene. And they've done things in the past like bioengineering skin and kind of tattooed bioengineered skin. And I think some of the things they're exploring are a bit out there, but it's a very interesting territory.
I'm going to have to stop you there and ask you the question that everybody listening to this podcast is wondering. And that question is, why?
Why? That's a stupid question. It's art. You don't ask why.
Does that
it
mean
just is.
You've got carte blanche to do whatever the hell you want? Inject horse blood, trot around in hooves?
But you don't ask Picasso why. You know, why do you... It's just... It is.
It just is.
All right. Deal with it.
So how does this fit kind of into the wider bio art spectrum? Because I know bio art's a topic you've been exploring an awful lot recently.
Yeah, I'm to be honest, this seems to go a step further than the stuff that I've seen before. I've seen people take their own body cells and then grow them in the lab into either tissue sculptures. I've seen people mix cells from two different animals, but outside of, you know, it, not in their body. But actually injecting another animal's blood into your own body seems like... To me, it seems a kind of step even further. But yeah, it's certainly interesting. I'm not sure how many other people will be jumping on that bandwagon. But
well, before we shudder ourselves into creepy oblivion, shall we move on to our feature?
Let's move on to our feature.
It just happened. There was no family discussion about should we, shouldn't we? It was just, oh, we're having a chimp. We're going to teach a sign language. And then the reality of it is sort of hitting you that it's really, you know, it's alive. It's not a doll. It's not a toy. It's not a human. It's a chimp. And it's amazing, sweet little newborn baby, needy creature. So I think I fell in love instantly.
This is Katie for Wired.co.uk, and I'm speaking to Simon Chin, who is producer of a new film, Project Nim, which is out today, 12th of August. So, Simon, can you tell me a bit more about the film?
Yeah, sure. I mean, basically, it's the story of a chimpanzee called Nim Chimpsky, who was named, interestingly, after Noam Chomsky, who had a theory of language that basically said that only humans were innately capable of language. And the idea of the experiment was to bring a chimp up as a human, in as far as that was possible, to raise it in a human human home in New York in the 70s, to see if he could acquire sign language and use sign language in the way that we use language to communicate thoughts and feelings. It was a pretty radical idea at the time.
I'm sure. So it happened in the 1970s. So how did you find out about the story?
Well, James Marsh, the director, and I had made a film called Man on Wire, and we'd been sort of chucking ideas back and forth after Man on Wire. And, I mean, Man on Wire was just such an amazing story. It kind of felt that the bar was somewhat high for us. So it wasn't easy. But I had the very good fortune, actually, to come down for breakfast one morning. My wife was reading an article in a British colour supplement about Nim's story. She was quite heavily pregnant at the time, and it really sort of moved her. And I was just incredibly struck by this, I guess, particularly in her state, you know, as an imminent mother. I think it sort of touched something quite profound in her. And I think it really is for me, it was always a story about how we discharge our responsibilities to those that are more vulnerable than us, you know, be they chimpanzees or children. So I think to that extent, it is a story as much about parenting as anything.
We got, it was a 28-acre estate surrounded by lovely gardens, and that allowed me to put up NIMS teachers in magnificent surroundings and not pay any rent. The life is good.
And Nim had several parents, so how did you track them down, and were they willing to talk to you?
Well, I actually optioned a book that this article was sort of drawn from by a journalist called Elizabeth Hess, and it was a kind of very arresting idea. The book it was an attempt to sort of to tell the story of an animal as a sort of biography, really. So. So I contacted Elizabeth Hess, and I mean she in fairness had done a lot of the legwork and had built very good relationships with a number of the key characters in our film. Stephanie Lafarge, Nim's first mother, being one of her kind of principal contacts. So very quickly we were kind of introduced to a number of the kind of key characters in Nim's story, who all seemed kind of very willing, sort of after 30 odd years, to tell Nim's story, and to tell it in a kind of very honest and sort of candid way, and to confront some of the kind of tough realities of the story. You know, out of a sense of remorse, really, about what had happened ultimately to Nim.
And obviously, it's very personal for each of these people. You mentioned remorse. You do leave the film feeling that some people did treat Nim very badly or didn't do enough for him. Were people comfortable admitting their sort of feelings about that?
Well, I think they were, and I think they kind of very very much everyone, you know, really without exception, I think, approached our interviews with a very, very open mind and a kind of willingness to be sort of honest and straight and to be sort of transported back to their memories. And the film very much plays as a sort of narrative and a sort of beat by beat. And, you know, it is a retrospective story, but I think to a great extent, it feels like a story that's sort of told in the present tense, because everyone's memories of their time with Nim are so vivid, and all the people in the story with that, you know, were deeply affected, and I think to a very great extent defined by their experience with Nim. And actually, you know, as much as Nim's fortunes, you know, in the course of his life over 26 years were very sort of changeable. I mean, I think what one of the things that sort of that I was very struck by with the story was how poignant and kind of profound some of the relationships that he formed with the humans around him were. And you know, there's a character in the film called Bob Ingersoll who kind of emerges in our story as the sort of hero and sort of rescues Nim from a rather unhappy fate at a certain point in his life. And there's a lot of, you really get a sense of, you know, this very deep bond that kind of emerges between Nim and Bob. And it's incredibly touching. I was very, very struck by the idea, actually, that an animal could form such a close and deep relationship with a human, very much like the kind of relationships we have with other people. And Bob was sort of able to achieve that rather uniquely in our film by sort of meeting Nim much more on his own terms than the others in the story were. I mean, a lot of the humans in our story were concerned with trying to treat Nim like a human being. But Bob actually met Nim, sort of moved more towards being a chimp with Nim, if that's possible. And you can see that in the film. There's remarkable footage of Bob's sort of spending time with Nim, where you really kind of get a sense of that.
We just liked each other right off, and sometimes it's like that. Chimps aren't humans. You have to kind of understand chimps to be able to understand how to work with them and be with them. I'm out on walks. I didn't bring food. I didn't do the kind of things that would interrupt the relationship or the building of the relationship.
You mentioned the footage there. I mean, there's a vast amount of footage in the film that's sort of interweaved with the interviews. And a lot of it is very, very personal. Where did the footage come from?
A lot of the footage came from the characters in the film. Stephanie Lafarge, who I mentioned, sort of trawled her attic at a certain point for us and sort of uncovered a lot of sort of Super 8 home movie footage, which you see in the earlier part of the film, dealing with Nim's early life in New York in Manhattan in the 70s, and then later on Bob spent a lot of time filming with Bob Ingersoll spent a lot of time filming with Nim, so he turned over 30 hours of that footage to us, and then we had an archive researcher in New York kind of trawling all the commercial sources of footage, and she turned up a couple of amazing bits of footage. There's one in particular where Nim the language study is abandoned at a certain point. Nim goes back to where he was born, which is a primate research center in Oklahoma, and there's a moment where he is introduced to one of his own, another chimpanzee. And really for the first time, it's the first time that he sort of realizes that he's actually not a human. He's a chimp. And it's an incredibly sort of revealing piece of footage. Nim kind of goes from sort of bewilderment to a kind of dawning realization of what and who he is.
Last of all, I wanted to ask you about the questions that the film raises. While it does focus on Nim and his life, then it does raise questions over the ethics of research into primates and also, obviously, animal testing. Is that something that you, as a film producer, were ready to engage with?
Well, in a way, not really. That was never the kind of objective of this film. You know, there's no sort of simple message to this film and to this story that we wanted to sort of peddle. Everyone will sort of draw their own conclusions from it. Some of those conclusions will be about human behavior, and other conclusions will be about chimpanzees and who and what they are, and the kind of environments that they should be allowed to inhabit and sort of to sort of exist in. I mean, from my point of view, I think chimps should be left to their own kind, and we should try not to mess with them too much.
Sure. Well, I guess the viewers will make up their own minds, but it does raise lots and lots of questions, and it is an incredibly heartwarming and heart-wrenching story. Simon, thank you ever so much for your time.
Thanks very much.
And that's Project Nim. That's out today, the 12th of August.
He was very dense, unlike a human baby that has fat. He was dense and hard. He didn't struggle. He didn't try to get away. He just screamed. As much as he may be screaming and protesting, he's also clinging. He was attaching for dear life.
Thanks, Katie. That sounds fascinating.
It does. It sounds really sad as well.
Yeah, a little bit. But I think he died about 11 years ago now in 2000. But yeah. he had a good innings for a chimp, about 26 years. That's not bad going. But with that, we're going to close this week's podcast, this week's Nateless podcast.
Yeah.
Miss you, Nate. Liv, how can people get in touch with us?
Well, as ever, you can follow us on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK. And also don't forget to follow our Facebook page. Go to facebook.com/WiredUK and hit the like button.
We had a bit of an issue with our Facebook page this week, didn't we?
Did we?
Yeah, we had to take down the image.
Oh, yes.
Because the cover line on the magazine this month, it's a little bit awkward. It's Europe is on fire, which didn't seem entirely appropriate.
No, so
have on Facebook.
Temporarily taken it down and replaced it with a more generic image.
But when things calm down, don't worry, it will be right back.
Setting the world alight.
And finally, if you want to email us, and you can and should email us with all of your thoughts on the podcast, anything that you want to say, you can drop us a line at podcast@wired.co.uk. We love hearing things from you. Anything else you would like to say to the listeners this week?
No, except just maybe find out what blood from animals people would like to inject into their bodies.
Yeah, that's a good one. Which, if you could share DNA with an animal, which animal would it be? Tell us, podcast@wired.co.uk.
What's yours?
Mine is, well, I said a hawk earlier, but then I got mocked, and Alice, our lovely assistant at the moment, said that I'm more like a tapir.
Oh.
What do you mean? Oh, tapirs are pretty awesome.
Are they? They're pretty... I mean, if you had a fight with a tapir and any other animal, it would lose.
I don't know about that.
Okay, which animal would it beat?
It would beat an ant.
Okay, well, that's... Right. No one ever wants to be an ant, though.
No, that's true. But yes, what about you?
Probably a horse as well.
A horse?
Yeah.
Running through the fields.
You're running through the fields. It was a bit annoying having hooves, though, I think. But anyway.
You can ask the nice French lady what it's like.
Oui.
We'll see you next week.
Bye.
That horrific?
Great use of the word fetlock, which is a
very
specific
much.
Piece of horse knowledge.
I only know it because of My Lovely Horse. Are you familiar with My Lovely
no.
Horse?
No.
In the Father Ted Eurovision
okay.
special.